Welcome to Topple Uncaged. I'm Steve Topple, and over the next 20 minutes, I'll be bringing you the quickest firing news roundup of the week. I'll be getting down and dirty with a very special guest going through some big stories. I'll be taking a part of this week's Question Time, and also I'll be bringing you some of the biggest, most banging political tunes going. So, lock and load, people. Let's go.
Uncaged.
Well, I think there are a number of solutions, a number of different options, and we look at all options.
The ayes to the right, 258. The noes to the left, 303.
Yeah! Light up and burn it. You're burning the street.
What's up, everyone? I am Steve Topple. It is Sunday, the 17th of February, and that can only mean one thing. It's this week's edition of Topple Uncaged. Yes, the world is in chaos. The coup rattles on in Venezuela. Brexit is absolute madness. The EU is imploding before our very eyes. Haiti is burning. Africa is in meltdown. And never mind what's happening elsewhere. Could 2019 be the year that Babylon, that is capitalism, does indeed start burning down? If that's the case, trust me, I'll be there on the front line with my pitchfork and torch. But for the time being, I will bring you on this show two of the most revolutionary radical voices going. Plus a bit of radicalism from myself, of course. As always, we will get you underway with the UK's quickest news roundup, Pluck News. Then I've got a fantastic guest reporting from Venezuela on the ground in free flying with... I will be taking down one of Babylon's darkest arts, BBC Question Time. And I've got the most sensational radical musical guest to finish off the show with. So, fuck you, Yellow Jackets. All we need is a bit of punk and some decent radical thinking. And who knows, 29 could be the year that the system falls down. The fastest news segment in the UK, it's Plucked News. You don't need any introduction to this section anymore. It is, of course, Plucked News, the UK's quickest news roundup. 5 news stories, 5 minutes, all the information you will need, plus a bit more. So if you're ready, in 3, 2, 1... First off, we're up to the Telegraph, and they shat themselves as they reported that climate change strike, traffic outside Parliament at standstill, as students take day off school to protest. This is, of course, the story of the National Youth Strike for Climate, where across 60 towns and cities in the UK, students took the day off school to go and protest about the impending climate catastrophe we're all facing. This is, of course, part of a wider global movement which was headed up originally by Greta Thunberg, the young girl from Sweden who was striking at school. Now, of course, don't get me wrong, I think this is absolutely fantastic. I love this because at the end of the day, these young people are the ones who are going to be most impacted at the minute by the climate catastrophe that our governments, politicians and corporations are doing nothing to avert. And it's also really heartwarming to see so many young people politically active, engaged and involved with what is going on around them. However, this movement now needs to expand into something larger because, of course, we're not just facing a climate catastrophe, we are facing an ecological catastrophe. Just this week, there was this report out based on 73 other reports that said if we're not careful, in 100 years, all insect life will be extinct on this planet. This could be catastrophic. We are literally entering the sixth mass extinction event. Climate change, ecological catastrophe, it's all one and the same thing. It's all crony corrupt capitalism and hierarchies which are to blame. So hopefully this youth strike will inspire more young people to get involved and hopefully open their eyes to what is going on around them. That is, this system is falling apart. And for story number 2, I'm off to Vox.com, and this is an old story from January. However, I am bringing it up for a reason. They reported that Trump is looking for a new way to cut Medicaid without Congress. Medicaid, the US program for support for people on low incomes with their medical care, is looking like it's going to be subject to numerous reforms. Now, why have I picked this out? Well, because one of the reforms that Trump and some of the administrations are looking at is for 25 million Americans to cut their Medicaid support based on work eligibility or give them work-related requirements or make them do community service type roles in order to get their Medicaid. Now, the reason I've brought this up is people often view the UK as some sort of lapdog to the US, which in terms of military intervention and quite often foreign policy may well be in part true. However, quite often where we're not a lapdog to the US is in terms of policies like Department for Work and Pensions, Welfare, Social Security, whatever you want to call it. Not least, as UN Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty Philip Olson pointed out in his report on the UK, he basically said Republicans in the US would have loved to have implemented the cuts to public services that the Conservative government have in the UK over the past few years. But moreover, as I say, the UK is essentially a trial for other social security systems around the world. Work-related requirements for Medicare, community service-based jobs. What does that sound like to you? Climate commitments in the UK? The sanctions regime? Workfare? Yes, we've seen this all before over here, and it looks like we were doing a trial for the large insurance companies and the American government in the US. Speaking of the DWP, and for story number three, I'm off to a disability news service, and my mate John Pring reported that MPs here have ways to save benefit claimants from harm, or even death. This is the story of Labour's Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell organising a lobby called First Do No Harm at Parliament. Essentially, this lobby is focused on the continuing refusal of ministers to ensure that sufficient medical evidence is gathered before decisions are made about claims for out-of-work benefits, particularly for disabled people and those in mental distress. Now, we all know the background to this. The work capability assessment, fit for work assessments, medical assessments for personal independence payments, they are all broken beyond repair. As I previously reported, 10 claimants a day were dying waiting for a decision on their PIP. And the deaths of claimants in these circumstances were one of the issues that was raised. Now, don't get me wrong, again, I welcome this kind of action. The work capability assessment in particular needs a complete overhaul. Private companies need taking out of the process and it needs bringing back in hands. But bringing back into hands of what is the issue? DWP is broken beyond repair. It does not need moving off to another department. It does not need outsourcing. It needs a root and branch, raising to the ground first review of what is going on. That is not going to happen under Conservative government. And while, as always, I'm not overly supportive of Jeremy Corbyn, it will only happen under a Labour one. And for story number four, I'm off to The Guardian, and they reported that Caster Semenya is unquestionably a woman, say her lawyers. To be honest, I cannot believe this story is still going on. Yes, this is a disgraceful tale of Caster Semenya, the female athlete who, several years ago, many people were saying, no, she's a man. Seriously, she's still having to go through this to try and prove her right to compete in the sport that she loves. Now the South African government has come out and backed her, but still this rumbles on. There's a whole campaign on social media, hands off Semenya. But the broader point of this story is, of course, the undertones that exist with it. There's blatant racism here, there's blatant sexism here, there's blatant isms about gender here, but ultimately this is of course also about South Africa, a country that doesn't naturally align to the West and is steering to more Russia and China, a country that threw off the shackles of colonialism and apartheid, and ultimately that Semenya and the country in sports and they can now compete on the world stage. The whole storm surrounding this is basically a racist and colonialist hangover by white Western imperialists. So yes, hands off Semenya, please. And finally, I'm back home to the Canary, and my mate Mohamed El Marzi, who reported that Cuba warns of US military build-up near Venezuela. This is, of course, the story of the Cuban government coming out saying that they think US special forces are not only amassing on the Colombian border, but there's been special forces flights going over other borders as well, essentially looking to invade Venezuela, probably surrounding the time that the first humanitarian aid will be going in. Now, I can tell you now, I'll be discussing this whole issue with a very special guest in the next segment. However, I want to touch on this story because, again, it shows that we are seeing the textbook playing out of the traditional corporatist Western imperialist blueprint of how to overthrow a person in a country. But moreover, I also want to use this opportunity to give a massive shout out to all the global team at the Canary. Their reporting on Venezuela of late has been absolutely top notch. We've been one of the leading outlets reporting a different narrative to the one that the mainstream press is giving you. So everyone, go to www.thecanary.co, search Venezuela, and you'll find all our articles on the subject. Big up the Canary. And I hadn't even had time to mention my mates Occupy London tweeting that, come on, socialist worker, and your other fronts like Anti-Racism Day and People's Assembly, isn't it time you just stop trying to co-op and hijack other people's grassroots movements? You're part of the problem, not the solution. I have nothing to add to that, apart from the fact that all those organisations are a bunch of middle-class infiltrators and class carpetbaggers. And I haven't really got time to mention it, but I do need to. My mate on Twitter, DepressedDog74, check out his timeline. He shared a post from my other mate, Paula Peter, who's saying that her GP surgery is now going over to telephone-only appointments. I am not sure what this is all about. Check out the tweet that's in the show notes. Really weird. What fresh hell is this? Seems like more cuts to services to me. And I haven't really even got time to talk about the government worm on fracking appearing to turn. Yes, that's right, the government has refused a second site in Lancashire for those rogues quadrilla. Love it, get in. That's right, quadrilla, frack off. And I have to quickly mention Trump declaring a national emergency in the US to get his damn Mexico wall built. The only national emergency in the US is Trump himself. Meanwhile, the only national emergency in the UK is Piers Morgan sucking off Trump's cock by tweeting support for him. And I must also give my unpopular opinion of the week. That is, I see Andrew Neil is stepping down as this week's host and the BBC is now axing the flagship political programme. Andrew Neil may be a right-wing bigot. However, he is the best political presenter the BBC has got. Apart from Emily Maitlis, to be fair. I don't know what they're going to do if she leaves. They'll be royally fucked. And that's it. There'll be more Plucked News next week. However, now I've got an extremely exciting and special guest coming up. Dissecting this week's top stories, it's me, Free Flying, with... I have a very special guest on this week's edition of Topple Uncaged, and we are talking about a very, very important subject at the minute. This guy has been out in Venezuela for the past, well, it's nearly a week now actually, reporting from the ground, putting out some absolutely staggering material. He is at the forefront of trying to reveal the counter-narrative to what the mainstream media are pushing, if you like. Not only is he here at the forefront of this, he is, in my opinion, probably one of, if not the most important journalists on this planet at the minute, if not over the past few years. I'm really humbled to have him on. I'm also very privileged to have him on because I know how busy he is. It is exceptional, the incomparable Max Blumenthal. Max, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It is really, really, really appreciated.
Well, it's an honor, and thanks for that very humble introduction. I hope I can live up to it.
As if, I'm sure you will now. I mean, this just briefly for the listeners at home, I need to add the caveat, of course, that we are recording this in the early hours of Friday, the 15th of February. So by the time this goes out, well, there may have been a change in the situation in Venezuela. But briefly, you've been there now. It's nearly a week, isn't it? Where exactly have you been stationed in Venezuela?
Well, just in Caracas, the main reason to be here was to get a sense of the situation on both the government and opposition side, and both of them had rallies on the 12th, and there have been a lot of kind of rallying support for the government initiatives around town that I've been covering at thegrayzoneproject.com. I'm working on a video from the opposition rally from Tuesday that'll be out shortly, probably by the time this is up. But I've just been in the capital city, the largest city in Venezuela so far. And while conditions in Caracas may not be exactly indicative of, economic and social conditions around the country, it definitely is where the politics of this country will be decided.
No, absolutely. And I look forward to seeing that content that's coming out. I mean, I was sitting here before we started talking, and I do what I always do when I do an interview. I kind of think over questions in my mind. I sort of storyboard it out, and I get a rough idea of what I want to say. And I just sat back and thought, I just want to know what the fuck is actually really going on the ground, because especially in the UK, the skewed reporting of this, aside from what we have on social media, our entire mainstream press, as I'm sure it is in the US, is completely skewing the narrative. It's abysmal. From being there, what is your assessment at this time of Maduro's position? How is he? How stable is he?
Well, the position of his... I mean, first of all, everything is reduced to Maduro, and that's not the reality in Venezuela. I mean, he's not a figurehead, and he's definitely a strategic thinker, but he is really at the top of a much wider apparatus with a very strong grassroots base, which is, and while the grassroots base is tired from years of economic warfare, from an economic crisis, which is very real, Maduro's in actually a pretty strong position domestically, and his government is in a strong position, so that there could even be a possibility where in a few years or in a few months, Maduro creates some kind of means of having an exit strategy for himself and is replaced by someone within the PSUV, which is his party, which was established by Hugo Chavez, I think, in 2007. You have the military, which is solidly behind Maduro. And that was the first mistake of the Trump administration and the neocons and the kind of right-wing Miami lobby, was the idea that the military would somehow defect and flip to the other side. We've only seen two high-ranking officers do that out of something like 2,000. So the military's strongly with this government. The Chavista base, what I've been finding is that the strongest elements of that base are older people who lived through the neoliberal period of the Fourth Republic, which preceded Chavez. They are solidly behind Maduro. And then you just have a wider sector of the population, which is very suspicious of U.S. intervention, even elements within the opposition. So I think what we've witnessed so far is a major miscalculation on the part of Washington. Shocking, that the same people who thought that the Iraq War would be a cakewalk, and that Libya would be a democracy, and that Assad would immediately go in Syria, are the same people who thought that Maduro would be out within a few days as soon as Marco Rubio, this kind of Miami Cuban preppy, snapped his fingers. And that's just not the way it is down here, and it's not the way it's going to be. The coup has failed internally. It is completely fizzled out internally.
That's really interesting, and you sort of touch on what Maduro's supporters are like. On the flip side of that then, so Guaido's supporters, who are they? Are they in the numbers that our press are making out? What is the sort of demographic of them? What's your feeling about who that base is?
Well, Venezuelan society is completely politically polarized, more so than even the U.S., certainly more so than the U.K., and it's polarized along class and racial lines. So when you go to a pro-government rally, people are darker skinned, they're mestizo, they're Afro-Venezuelan, they're clearly working class, they're wearing, you know, they're not wearing brand name clothes. They live outside the city in the barrios. They benefited from Chavismo, and they are willing to fight for it. And then when you go to the opposition rally, it is in a neighborhood and an area that would be considered affluent even in a Western city. And they look like me and you. And the women, they dye their hair blonde. Everybody's wearing brand name clothes. People are excessively polite in a kind of Western way, and they're presenting themselves as the sort of civilized sector of Venezuelan society. And they have an imperialist narrative of welcoming the U.S. in and wanting the U.S. to intervene. Whereas if you talk to people at the base of government support, they have a very sophisticated anti-imperialist narrative, which is just kind of baked in the cake here.
It's a staggering paradox, really, because you said that the sort of Maduro supporters, government supporters, are the poorest, the working class, and yet these are the very people which our media is portraying to us as the ones who will have been hit hardest by what obviously is being branded our end, the sort of Chavista policies and corruption and mismanagement, etc., etc. Yet they're the ones still supporting the government.
Yeah, there is that paradox, and it's really apparent. Both when I went to see people who were signing a declaration, a letter to the American people denouncing intervention, and, you know, the lines just stretched for blocks and blocks, and people were waiting for hours. And, you know, you talk to them, and they're the ones, yeah, as you said, being hardest hit by the economic crisis. And the opposition and Washington are using hunger as a weapon to try to break these people, just as they use deprivation as a weapon against the population of the Gaza Strip, who still support, if not the Hamas government, then at least support the concept of resisting Israel. And they're using it to break them, and it's totally failed. In almost every situation, it sort of fails. But then you go to the opposition rally, and well, people there, I mean, you can't deny that they're not being affected by the economic crisis. They're the middle and upper middle and even upper class, and they're pretty well fed. I mean, people are much better fed than I am in many cases, and many of them are wealthier than a lot of Americans I know, and they're the ones calling on the humanitarian aid. And it's because they know in the back of their minds that it's not about humanitarian aid. It's about the U.S. intervening and creating a pretext for some kind of escalation, because their only hope is to ride into power on the backs of, you know, Colombian or U.S. tanks with the U.S. Air Force providing cover. They don't have the same popular base. And the opposition has been divided for 10 years. So the irony is really strong, especially when you go to the opposition rally and see people who are of means, and they're, you know, you ask them, are you hungry? And they're like, well, I'm not hungry, but I'm here for the hungry people. Again, there is hunger in Venezuela, for sure, more than there has been in a while. But no one speaks to those people, or it's rare we hear from them.
What is the public feeling towards the sort of U.S. and Western policy over this?
Well, you know, people who are with the opposition in the opposition base don't seem to look at humanitarian aid with any skepticism. But the reality is that the humanitarian aid will come in through USAID, which is a wing of the State Department, was founded out of the CIA, and has an Office of Transitional Initiatives, which exists for the sole purpose of funding and fueling regime change in countries targeted by the West. So it's, you know, you have this spoon-fed narrative from the private oligarch-owned pro-opposition channels that the Maduro government is, you know, evil and wants to starve people, and that the aid needs to come across. And so some of the more credulous members of the opposition will accept that narrative. But, you know, the people on the pro-government side who have an anti-imperialist narrative, and it's a sophisticated one, understand what this represents. when you have U.S. trucks barreling across the border.
How is it actually on the ground? How are people? How bad are conditions now? What have you been seeing over the past few days since you've been there?
Yeah, that's another important issue to talk about because of the contrast between the way it's presented in Western media and the reality on the ground. The dystopia is digital, but it's not what I'm seeing here in Caracas, having been in the poorest and wealthiest areas. Right now, I actually started out staying in one of the poorer areas, and I'm now staying in one of the more affluent areas. And food is plentiful. There is food everywhere. There are not empty shelves. There are no lines for food. People are out in the streets carrying on business as usual. The parks in the daytime are full of people, you know, doing their thing. There's one park in a more working class area where young men just like work out, and they have public workout areas. And, you know, it just feels like a normal city in South America. That's what it feels like. However, all isn't well. Food prices are really high for certain items. Right now, because of sanctions, a box of diapers costs like $30. People don't know why certain items cost so much. I went out and got rice the other day, and it was really cheap. But at the same time, coffee was expensive. Sometimes I went to a supermarket last night, and it was a giant supermarket that was full of everything. But you know, I have U.S. dollars, so I have massive buying power here. But people that have bolivars don't have buying power because of hyperinflation. The 1,000,000% inflation we hear about, I think that figure itself is inflated, exaggerated, but it's not good. People's buying power is massively decreased, and a lot of poor people are surviving off of CLAP, which is free food delivery each month that gives them a substantial amount of food and basic foodstuffs to survive on, but it's not very glamorous. It's prevented starvation in a lot of cases, but it's not pretty. But you know, you don't see people just starving and dying in lines of people waiting for food. People are able to maintain, a fairly normal level of existence here, and things are available if you can pay for it. It's important to remember that 2/3 of the Venezuelan economy is controlled by private capital. This is not the socialist state that I think a lot of Chavistas would like it to be. But I really believe that people in this region, at the grassroots base, will not stand for business as usual in the Washington consensus.
That's a very fitting and I think quite accurate way to end, Max. I was transfixed listening to you, actually. That's why I didn't say much during the whole interview, because I was just listening and taking it all in. You're an exceptional orator, if not journalist as well. And it was absolutely fantastic to get your views and to also to hear what you've seen. And I hope people listening at home have also had some insight into what is actually going on, which we all know isn't what's being sold to us. But Max Blumenthal, for the minute, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. It was a real privilege and a very humbling experience. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve, and thanks for all the work you and everyone at the Canary are doing.
Cheers. Thank you. How amazing is Max? But I'll tell you what's more amazing, the full interview that I did with him about the situation in Venezuela. That is going to be out later today, Sunday the 17th of February, on both the Canary's YouTube channel and on its main website, www.thecanary.co. You need to check that out. Taking down this week's BBC QT, it's question time. Tobble chirps back. It was a rather curious episode of BBC Question Time this week, but for me it summed up one thing: the way the Overton window has shrunk to a pinprick. Why do I say that? Two people on the show, one Grace Blakely, two Jacob Rees-Mogg, because both of those have presented as polarised images of the left and the right in this country. Grace Blakely, shown as some sort of revolutionary economist, when really she's just a fairly bog-standard democratic socialist. And then Jacob Rees-Mogg, the old-school establishment far right, when essentially all he is a traditional Tory, and he looks a bit peculiar, because we've all forgotten what traditional Tories are like. These people are hardly Lucy Parsons. But is this painting of anyone on Corbyn's team being extremely far left and anyone on the Brexit team being extremely far right? Which is this Overton window? It is just preposterous that we're in this position now. These people are not radical. They're pretty damn boring. Anyway, on with the questions. First one, please, question time.
Brexit plans don't appear to be any further forward. Have the British people been let down by politicians who are pursuing their own agendas?
Oh, the hashtag bants on this week's question time. You seriously think that politicians only pursue their own agendas when it comes to Brexit? This is the whole problem with our society. Most MPs in Parliament, and there are a few exceptions to the rule, most of them are there for the Westminster gravy train. They don't give a shit about you and me. They're literally there to line their own pockets, feed their own faces at the restaurants, and drink themselves stupid at the bars in Parliament, and make sure that after they've either been voted out by their constituents or decide to give up their seat, they have a nice cushy job to walk into afterwards. Politicians have been letting us down for hundreds of years. Brexit is just one very good example of this, but I think the broader example is the neoliberalism policies since Margaret Thatcher of the 1980s. That's what has ultimately got us into this mess. Thatcher, Blair, Cameron, Brown, Theresa May. We are in this mess because of them and because of neoliberal capitalism. So if you want the biggest letdown of all, it is that. Next question, please.
Considering the ever-increasing estimated cost, is it now time to scrap HS2?
I think the audience reaction for a change matches my opinion on this. Yes, I do think it should be scrapped. Started by the crony corporatist capitalist David Cameron and continued by the incompetent Theresa May, it is one of the biggest white elephants in the government's current budget infrastructure plans. But of course we know why this is, because it will benefit the City of London. This money should be spent on national rail infrastructure around the country, which is creaking under the strain and literally falling apart in some places. So I applaud the audience back. Bring down HS2. And if I was an audience member in this week's Question Time and I wanted to pose some questions to the panel, I think I'd start with the following. Why do people keep getting their tits out with Brexit signs and Brexit slogans painted on them? Could you at least do it for something worthwhile, like, I don't know, 10 people a day dying at the hands of the DWP? I would also ask, 16 years after the march against the Iraq War, is it time that we actually started considering the fact that these A to B marches no longer work? Because if a Labour government didn't listen to people then, a Tory one certainly ain't going to now. And that's it, question time. I must make a note of the fact that you didn't start with the Brexit story. Very impressed, and brownie points for you. Until next week. And here's this week's banger in Revolutionary Birdsong. I'm constantly in a state of excitement with the guests I manage to get on my podcast, and this next artist is no exception to that rule. This album is absolutely mind-blowing. I don't know where this guy's been hiding in my life, but I'm quite pleased I found him now, because the album Crown is outstanding. It's just a staggering piece of work. So I'm very, very, very excited and pleased to introduce King Mass. Mass, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast.
Yes, thank you very much for having me. You know, I took yourself.
It is a real pleasure. My first question to you is, where the fuck have you been hiding? Because this album, literally, I am like, me and my girlfriend sat and listened to this album, and like our jaws were just on the floor throughout the whole thing. This is something else, Crown. It is absolutely staggering. It is the most overarchingly broad mix of music that I've heard for a while. We have got a constant reggae influence through some of the tracks with the bubble pattern going on. You go into kind of neo soul, which was screaming a bit of Erykah Badu at me. Then you move into kind of Maxwell territory. There's a constant calypso influence throughout it. We've got dancehall banger. For you, I mean, it's such an expansive project. Where was the motivation for such an eclectic album? Where did this come from?
Well, the central theme, the Crown theme, that song is the sort of the crux of everything else that happened around it. And that song came to me about 4 years ago, just looking at some of the issues that face the nation at the moment. And when you look at a lot of the social decay or the moral decay that's taking place in society, especially among the youth, they want to blame it on a lot of things, but I think the ultimate factor is what happens in the home. And when the homes are disjointed, when masculine and feminine energy cannot dwell together in peace and in balance, it creates a situation in which the children are vulnerable to all manner of influences. And then when they go off the rails, we want to pathologize them, we want to institutionalize them, we want to stigmatize them, when the key factor, as I perceive it, is the breakdown of the family structure. And so as a practitioner of music, from the perspective that I practice it as, you know, a sort of scientist within the music and looking at the healing properties of what music can do, my endeavor was to attempt, even in a small way, to repair some of the damage, speaking as a man, because we're not perfect, and nobody is, but speaking from a masculine perspective, I wanted to do all I could to sort of heal that broken bond.
It's a very conscious album, from tracks like Round and Round to Militant Step. You're talking about capitalism, the effects of it, the breakdown of society. But I'll come back to that later. Just to talk about the music briefly, as I said, it's an overarching, eclectic album. It is absolutely stunning. Where did you first find out you could do all this? Because it really is amazing.
Singing in particular is inborn. I come from a lineage of griots, of musicians.
Yeah, because your dad was a calypso artist, wasn't he?
Yes, he's a calypso king from the island of Montserrat, a former island-wide champion. And so is his uncle, you know, Everton Reality Weeks, who's responsible for one of the biggest songs that the Caribbean culture has ever contributed to the global culture. You know? Me heart on fire, me soul on fire, feeling hot. Now, that is the lineage from which I descend. Wow. So with that being the case, I feel it's an inborn thing. And I really can't remember a point where I wasn't singing. Even before I have memories of really singing or doing anything, I'm told from people who knew me as a toddler that I was just singing from that time. I've always been that way. So it's an ancestral tradition that I just inherited.
And the music writing then, how far back does that stretch?
Probably as far as the age of 12, but I've always been, I have to give credit really to my mother, because my mother worked in early childhood education.
Okay.
She's basically runs a creature, a daycare. And I was a part of the first group of children. You know, she felt very guilty about sending, I'm second born. And when she had my elder sister and had to give her to someone in order to go back to work, she felt extremely guilty. She didn't like the separation. And when I was born, she made a decision and said, no, I can no longer do this. So she established that business. And 31 years later, she's still doing it. You know, in our household, literacy and education are highly emphasized. And so my sort of vocabulary and the way that I can weave words, I have to largely credit her, and also the musical influences that sort of color my work, especially coming from the calypso perspective. Because when you listen to calypso music, it's a lot of storytelling, especially the early, I mean, even up to now. But, you know, of course, I was raised largely on, you know, Sparrow and Arrow and Lord Kitchener and all of them. So
I want to move back to talking about the sort of political and social messages behind it. It's a very light album. It exudes positivity almost, and a kind of, while it's sending out messages, as you say, about the state of society, the state of politics, the state of living under capitalism, it's still overly positive. Was that your intention, to create something that was firstly accessible, because it is extremely accessible in terms of its music, but also that was a positive message about where we're at, but what we could be if as a species and as a society? Was positivity what you were aiming for?
Well, a duality is what I was aiming for. You know, if you know anything about King Mas, and my moniker is the musical Obiaman. And when you look into African spiritual traditions, the emphasis is always on balance and keeping all of the four elements, or the various elements, in alignment, so that, you know, the holistic health of an individual is maintained. And so when I was creating the album, I knew that I wanted to touch on some topics that were heavy. And so I wanted to make sure that I balanced the tone, so that it is, it's just like with actual medicine. You know, if you, as a healer, sometimes in order to get someone to take a medicine which is necessary and bitter, you have to take the edge off of it a bit. And so that it's not as if I'm trying to steer away from the impact, because the messages hit, when they hit with heavy impact regardless. But I wanted to make sure that those who aren't necessarily drawn to that would get a chance to be exposed to it through some of the other vibes and energies that are present.
Now, the other standout thing about Crown for me was the artwork. It's stunning what you've done, and it's a fascinatingly ingenious and also beautiful, actually, concept. You've taken one visual theme, and then you've expanded on it from incorporating each artist, which is also featured on the album, to the overriding main image for it. Where did this come from?
Well, the foundational piece in terms of the main image, which is the album cover, which includes myself and my wife, my empress, that was done by a sister by the name of Koka Zahori Dosa out of Jamaica. So, you know, it's really the hands of a woman that crafted the whole energy and the whole motif. So I want to big her up for setting that standard. And then once I had that panel in place, I actually had a brethren from over on this side, and by the name of Amadeus Underwood, do a rendering of each featured artist so that, you know, I could have those images to even extend to them as a way of, you know, thanking them for being a part of the kingdom overall and supporting the messages being put across. And, it creates this almost, you know, this visual universe. It brings you into a whole universe of all of these various energies, and it's a very beautiful thing.
Just to wrap up, I mean, what was the overarching thing that you would like people to take away from Crown? What is the overriding message that you were aiming for?
Well, I'd say in the very beginning, sort of what we just discussed, that round and round, the concept of Dunia, which is beautifully expressed by Jali Phyllis Sissoko. And from there, we go right into, you know, the masculine and feminine balance and kind of what should be the approach for us as men, knowing that in many regards, you know, the masculine energy has been very harmful to the planet, out of balance, you know, and feminine energy, you know, they talk about toxic masculinity, and it does exist. And I also would argue that toxic femininity exists. I think that any sort of energy applied unskillfully or applied in an egotistical way can be destructive. And then we move forward into even the realms of conspiracy theory, you know, things like flat earth, you know, my stance on things of that nature is we need to focus on the tangibles. We need to focus on food, shelter, you know, water. How are we going to clothe ourselves? How do we heal ourselves? Do we know the herbs around us to keep our bodies in ideal condition as well as our mind? And then from there, you know, you go into militant step, and that one really deals with the principle of motion, in a sense that sometimes, especially, you know, as far as Rastafari is concerned, or consciousness is concerned, when you're considered a socially conscious person, some people sort of conflate that with being pacifistic. They conflate that with being passive and neutral in how you address certain things.
There are so many takeaways from what you've just said that I can lift off and apply to immediate situations. That's why it's such an amazing album. It is a stunning piece of work, and you should be thoroughly, thoroughly overjoyed with what you have achieved. And I would urge everyone to listen to it. And if this doesn't blow up for you, then there's seriously something is fucked with society. It is quite groundbreaking. So it is. I mean, it's an absolute pleasure to listen to it. And it has been an absolute pleasure to talk to you as well, King Mass. Thank you so much for joining me.
You're very welcome, Steve. I just want to say, whenever I laugh, it's mostly because I take pleasure in the delivery. It's not, I agree with the message, I take it seriously, but I find your delivery, it's entertaining. I like it.
That is a compliment to me, but I would love to have you back on the game, because there is loads more we could have gone into. So please, if you're free anytime, feel free to come back on to game. But for the moment, King Mass, thank you.
Yes, I give thanks, Sashi.
King Mass is sensational, and I was hard pushed to pick a track for you guys at home to listen to off Crown, because they are all just things of beauty. However, I had to pick one, and it is the title track from the album. So here it is. This is absolutely stunning. It is Crown by King Mass.
inside this love between us, being something greater than you ever could imagine. Girl, I brought you falling in our love, healing from the pain is hard enough. And even though I know it's hard to trust, your heart is safe with me.
And that's it. Episode 14 of Topple Uncaged is done. I would like to thank my incredible guest this week, the incomparable Max Blumenthal. Follow him on Twitter. It's at Max Blumenthal. The sensational King Mass. Follow him on Twitter. It's at King Mass the Rass. As always, backstage, thank you to my gorgeous girlfriend, Nicola Jeffrey. Follow her on Twitter. It's at Nicola C. Jeffrey. And my sound engineer, Fire in the Booth. It's Gav Pause. Follow him on Twitter. It's at Pause with a Z Radio. Last but not least, my in-house singer. It's Ray Star Music. Follow her on Twitter. It's at Ray underscore Star 113. And as always, thank you to the Canary for uncaging me for another week. Bring on the revolution. I'm off to find my pitch. Pitchfork.
Uncaged.